only thought of one kind of thing that this week that I wanted to talk about, and it was sort of like in the nature of almost like review. Mm-hmm. So see how this strikes you and where we might go with it. And that's to go back to the sort of the question of what does emptiness refer to? I mean, I don't, maybe it'll seem redundant. Maybe it won't seem redundant. But it's easy to sort of go down a track a ways, and then sometimes it's really helpful to go back and kind of look at why did you go down there? What is this, mm-hmm. you know, sort of thing about? So I really wanted to start this evening with sort of like some basic kind of thing. And this occurred to me because I've been thinking a lot about time and process, about sort of like the flow of things. And when we started this class, I sort of deconstructed the flow of things. And I thought for myself, because of what I've been thinking about, maybe it would be interesting to reconstruct the flow of things. So is that?
Well, I had some, you know, questions to myself about, like, I noticed that I missed this second and third class, I think. And you went somewhere that I couldn't really grasp, and I was like, I was like missing the premise, some of the premises that you may have established when I was here.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and that's why I think we might have had some misunderstanding.
It's on tape.
That's true. One thing you could do is you can make copies of the tapes and listen to
them. Well, yeah, I really am not very good at listening to tapes, but if, you know, we may just clarify, well, you know, what the intention is and what some major definitions are, something like that. Like, that's mm-hmm. all I'm talking about.
Well, if I actually do this kind of like review thing, that'll be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
For you. And what was your name again?
Richard.
Richard. I think, Richard, what's happening here is this is sort of like an ongoing discussion from a class that's been here for some period of time. And I don't want to be disinclusive of you, but on the other hand,
I understand. Well, I'm sure I can pick up what I can.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks.
So let's see.
Like when you said, like, what does emptiness refer to?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I thought, well, okay, emptiness refers to form. And that's where my mind is. So when you say, what does it refer to, you want to place it in terms like a historical context?
No, what is, why don't I just do it?
Okay.
I'm going to get an idea of what I mean. Let's see who this is. Hi. So I think we definitely lost
Janet.
Mm-hmm. Oh well. Mm-hmm. Is she leaving or is she staying?
She's staying.
She's staying.
She's debating.
Oh, she's debating.
Well, but she's not debating.
They're debating.
They're debating.
Okay. There's a debate going on about that.
She's not.
One of my Tibetan teachers said that there are three basic arguments and three basic reasons for why things are empty. And I wanted to go back to what that was about. But there's even a step before that, which is that the basic view that I was taught, and I stress it this way, that the basic view that I was taught is the basic view that comes out of the Tibetan tradition, which is in itself not necessarily different than any of the other traditions, but it's very explicit in the Tibetan tradition, is that in order to remove a misunderstanding about something, you have to have a clear idea of what the misunderstanding is first. In other words, to really get rid of misunderstanding or delusion, say, as it's, you know, you usually say there's these three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion. to really get rid of the poison of delusion or of ignorance, you know, like the first of the 12 links of dependent origination, to really get rid of it, first you have to know what it is. You have to see something clearly before you can remove it. You can't just say, well, ignorance, I want to get rid of ignorance, and so the opposite of ignorance is wisdom, so I'm going to ignore ignorance and I'm going to learn everything there is about wisdom. And, but they say that, that the problem with that is that although wisdom is the antidote to ignorance, they're the opposite of each other, in order to really remove ignorance, you've got to know what it is.
You have to see the ignorance.
You have to have a real clear image of the problem area.
The seeing of the ignorance is the end of it.
No. The seeing of the ignorance is knowing what it is that has to be removed.
But wouldn't that be automatic?
They don't say so.
I can see my hate, you know, and I can see it come up and come up and come up. It doesn't mean I'm not going to have it anymore. You can see you want to start the beginning of
it. No, but if you see it, okay, if you see it fully, and you see the damage it does, and you, in turn, you really see the damage of it, the cost of it, the price of it, and you really see that. When I say see, I don't mean see.
No,
I mean see.
No, this is a discussion. This is a discussion. David, actually, I think I agree with you because you're talking about really seeing in a profound way.
Well, I didn't make this up. I heard this from somebody, Tony Packer, somebody. But they say the seeing of sorrow is the ending of it.
Okay.
So I see deeply into it.
Okay. You see that, but the point is, as you say, seeing deeply or really seeing.
Right.
And what we usually do is we see superficially. So we say, oh, I think I understand what grief is, or I understand what ignorance is, and that somehow is adequate. But you're talking about it on a deeper level, and I'm talking about it on a really deep level. But even so, you probably can't say that merely seeing it in itself automatically removes it. Okay. You could say that really, truly seeing ignorance requires the cultivation of wisdom. So in a sense, we're on the same line. But there is one other factor, and this is something that I think is not entirely clear in the Zen tradition. But as I've been listening closely to Reb's teaching, I've become convinced that it's there. And reading the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, I've also really ascertained clearly that it's there. It's that all of these things like ignorance or negative emotions, they're like a principle of human existence, but they're also sort of an accumulation of habit patterns. And as Sarah said, you can see something really clearly, like you can see really clearly that it's bad to smoke, but that in itself won't end the craving to smoke or the fact of smoking.
Only if you see it every time.
Even if you see it, you can still pick up a cigarette and smoke it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of this. This is truly clear that people can see that they're dying of lung cancer and they'll continue smoking. You know, I mean, or see that they're right on the edge and they'll continue. And they'll really get what it means and they'll still continue.
Well, it also matters about your intention, too. If your intention is, let's say, if your intention is to be healthy, and you see that smoking cigarettes is totally against your intention, mm-hmm. is killing you, then if you see that, based on your intention, you'll stop.
Well,
if your intention is not to be hateful, and you see your hate every time coming up, it will stop. If your intention mm-hmm. is to stop it, because the intention is the strongest thing.
But in the sense, the facts aren't there to support that. Unless what you mean is that in every single moment you have to make a decision. And in every moment you make a decision to do the wholesome thing rather than the unwholesome thing, or the wise thing rather than the ignorant thing. Okay, I mean, this isn't some sort of like abstraction that I'm speaking of. I mean, you can talk to physicians and people that work with addictions and say that's just the way human beings are. It's not, in that sense, it's not really a debatable point. Unless you want to say, well, none of those people really had a profound enough intention. So let me come back to anyhow what I was taught and sort of share that with you. The point is that to remove something like ignorance, you have to first truly see what it is. Okay? What does it mean to be ignorant? What is, how does it manifest? How does ignorance function? Then, when you truly see how, what it is, right, then you can take the steps to remove it. So it's at least a two-part process, ascertaining what it is and then doing something about it. Okay. So a lot of times, the Tibetan tradition is critiqued as being overly intellectual, for example, or overly analytic. People say, what's the point of all this, you know, philosophical, you know, hair splitting? And their response to that would be, it's not about philosophical hair splitting. It's about truly and accurately seeing where the problem areas are and not sort of almost getting them or not being slightly deluded by them. I mean, one example that I'll give, it's not like I want to debate the example, but just to give an example, is this question of the I and what does it mean to be selfless? And there's a lot of confusion over this particular issue. I mean, you read things that the Dalai Lama has been writing recently, and he'll say very directly, because now he understands what it is that's going on in Westerners' minds, he'll say, egolessness. We don't talk about egolessness. There is no such thing as egolessness. Egolessness would be a psychotic state if it were to be something that one encountered. Selflessness is something we talk about, but what does this mean? And he says, for example, that there is a desire in Buddhist practice to eradicate the false sense of selfhood, the erroneous sense of selfhood, but there's no interest in eradicating the real sense of selfhood. There's no sense of eradicating or desire to eradicate true selfhood, only to eradicate false selfhood. Oh, what's the difference then? You have to ascertain what's the difference. Now, I found in trying to talk to people about what is this subjective experience that is to be eradicated and what is not, there's tremendous confusion. For example, they'll even use this language, which is, they'll talk about the self which is to be eradicated and the self which is not to be eradicated. And now, this means like the subjective person. I don't mean self in the abstract sense of like any kind of thing or object, but what we call ego, okay, the sense of I-hood or I-ness. They say there's a certain I-ness which is not to be removed or not to be eradicated, and there's a certain quality of I-ness which in fact is to be eradicated. And that actually, most of us can't tell the difference between those two. That we actually don't experience what our selfhood is because we don't look at it clearly enough. We don't know how to look at it. And we don't know how to ascertain what's actually there and what's actually a complete fiction. And it's the fictional part which is to be removed. In fact, they would say that it's only the fictional part that could be removed, because anything that was really there you couldn't get rid of. The only thing you could get rid of is what's not really there. But the problem is that you can't figure out what's not really there. That's what's called delusion. Okay. So that's why you have to look very clearly and analytically at what experience is before you engage in the process of trying to remove part of it.
Can you give us like an idea of what people say are the real things and which people say are the false?
No, I'm not going to.
Categories of
no, I'm not going to. I wanted to use that as an example of what I use as an example of. And we can do that another week if you want, or maybe even later tonight, but not right now, because then we'll get off in a direction other than where I want to go. It's an important issue, but it's a little complicated, and it'll take basically a chunk of time. I want to go back to the question of emptiness, because understanding emptiness is about understanding, in order to really get what emptiness is about, you have to start with what it is that the term is applied to before you apply the term to it. Okay? And so we haven't gotten there yet. But this is the reason why you have to make this distinction. Okay? There's a giggle happening over here.
No, I laughed at something because something Douglas Harding said about emptiness starts here.
Emptiness starts here. Mm-hmm. What, emptiness is from here up?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any idea what that means. Who said that?
Douglas Harding was here.
I'm having no hope. Okay.
Well, he was a Zen practitioner, wasn't he? Now, you know, Zazen doesn't necessarily function this way, pretty clearly. But, again, from listening to Reb over the last 10 months, it doesn't really seem to me that there's a fundamental philosophical divergence over this issue and the Tibetan way of looking at it and the Zen way of looking at it. But I think from the point of view of technique, there is a very definite difference.
What do you mean Zazen doesn't do this? What does this? You mean...
The
analyzation and identify what the false self is?
Yeah, it seems, well, not just the false self. It seems to me that the idea that first you have to accurately identify what it is that's fictional or illusional about
experience. That doesn't necessarily happen, does that?
Yeah, my sense is that this two-part thing of like analytically identifying what's the problem area to be removed and then removing it is not part of the Zazen technology.
No, it might happen, but it's not part of it.
That's
train
right.
You how to do it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this is a matter of technique,
yeah.
But and a matter of preference. But I don't think that from the point of view of intention and goal or worldview fundamentally that there's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
See, there was a period of time, like when I first came here, that I was very cautious about talking this way, because I kind of there's like a worldview that sort of holds that the Tibetan Buddhist view and the Zen view are so radically different that they don't have a whole lot to do with each other in some fundamental ways. And as a matter of fact, they might significantly disagree with each other in fundamental ways. But what I've learned since I've been here is I actually don't think that that's true. I think that the differences are differences in approach and technique, but they're not differences in intention or goal. For me, that's been like, you know, one of the major learnings of the last 10 months of being here, is sort of personally resolving that split. So to get back to the question then of what it is that is to be seen clearly and accurately, it is that which is untrue. Okay. I sort of shot past this earlier in my comment, which was you can't either analytically or through meditation or anything else remove something from your experience that's true.
Mm-hmm.
You can only remove from your experience that which is fictional or illusory in some way. Because if it's removable, it's fictional. If it's not removable, it's true. So the Tibetans say, if you analyze really accurately anything, if you investigate really closely, if its appearance is more true in the process of investigating it, then it truly exists. If its appearance becomes more untrue if you correctly and accurately analyze, if it becomes more untrue to the point where it's not even findable anymore, then it didn't actually exist. Okay. So from their point of view, the whole point of this philosophy of emptiness, if you will, is literally to empty appearance of its falsehood, or better yet, to empty experience of its falsehood, not to empty appearance of its falsehood, to empty experience of its falsehood, so that what remains in experience is what's true, and what no longer remains is what's false. What's false is what our ignorance projects into experience. What appears to have certain qualities that it doesn't have. So, they give three traditional arguments for emptiness. And what those three traditional arguments are three ways, or three approaches, or vectors for emptying experience of its falseness in an analytic way. Now, the process is initially an analytic process. But it becomes a meditational process. And finally, it becomes just experiential. Okay. Again, they say that emptiness... They say that that which is coarsely true is something that we can understand with our minds and which we can experience. Jay?
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
That which we can coarsely... That, let's see. Coarse phenomena... This is more of a point of how they say it. Coarse phenomena can be seen for what they are directly. But subtle phenomena, which can't be directly seen, have to first be reasoned or thought about before they can be directly seen. Okay. For example, I think we can probably make agreements about what constitutes goodness.
Which?
Goodness.
Say that again?
We could probably make some agreements about what constitutes goodness or wholesomeness. I bet we could.
Okay. Some.
Yeah, I'm not saying we can define what means good, but I think we can make some agreements about what means goodness or wholesomeness.
The opposite, you say the opposite of unwholesomeness. Or would you go on beyond that?
Well, I would say probably saving someone's life, we would all agree, is an example of goodness or wholesome activity. No.
Generally speaking, I don't see why we're doing this.
Well, I'm just saying that in order to, I mean, you can't see goodness directly. Right, is something that gets defined or that has to be agreed upon.
Mm-hmm.
And having done that, then when an experience comes up that fits that definition, you'll see it as an experience, which is good. Let me go back to smoking. Okay, I mean, there was a period of time when people thought smoking was a big deal. Smoking cigarettes, great, no big deal. You know, it's sexy, it's whatever, you know. And nobody thought too much about it one way or the other. But now there's this whole body of evidence, which is that smoking is really not good for your health, you know. And you can look at somebody smoking a cigarette now, whereas like 40 years ago maybe you weren't sure about it. You look at somebody smoking a cigarette, you know they're harming their health when they're smoking a cigarette. You know? And that's pretty incontrovertible, and people will basically agree upon it. And they'll see that by just looking at that activity, whereas 40, 60 years ago that wouldn't have necessarily been the case at all. So it was ascertaining a phenomenon that had subtle aspects to it. And the reason the aspects were subtle was because the fruition of that activity took a long time and took many bits, you know, of that activity coming together before you saw the fruition of destroying your lungs. Right? So in that sense, it was a subtle phenomenon. You couldn't just see it. You had a reason about it. Okay. You get my point?
Well, the thing...
Can I use that as an example? Sure.
The point that you got into about removing something that's true and see if it
no, the other way around.
Okay, remove it, it's false. I was having a little problem with that, and what I was going to suggest to illustrate this is to use the three marks of existence and use them in this argument or in this discussion somehow, because if you just apply those three without getting into things like goodness and
you want to share with people what those are?
Do we know the three marks of existence? The three marks of existence are: existence is devoid of self-nature, which is also known as anatta or anatta. Things are impermanent, which is known as anicca. And things are productive of pain, which is dukkha. So I would think that if we experience a phenomenon and it did not meet any of those three, then we would find something that would be true or wholesome.
That is true. That's correct.
Is that where you're going with that?
No, that's not where I'm going with that. That's correct, but that really isn't where I'm going.
Because that way we could see an experience and say, oh, it's a transient experience. It's not true. we have an experience that's productive of pain, like attachment or old age and death or anything like this. So these are not ultimately true.
But that's not really where I'm going, because where I'm going is trying to get a clearer grasp on this term emptiness.
Okay.
And see, now you're including three issues which require definition: emptiness, impermanence, and ill. And we're going to have a problem with that, because you yourself...
No, I use the word, I said, devoid of self-nature.
Yeah, that means emptiness. Devoid of self-nature means emptiness. The word devoid means emptiness.
So not, well, I was not, it means no,
selfless.
No, and ego.
No.
And now we're getting into all this defining stuff, and I've almost lost the... I have to put a lot of effort into following your ideas, and they're very well strung together, and every time we jump way out on this other tangent, I feel like I'm losing it, and then when we come back to it, I have to struggle to keep up
you've got to keep more control.
Well, see, the problem that we're going to have here is the competing desires that Heather has for me to sort of logically string together a piece of discourse, and the desire that David has to engage in dialogue.
No, I'm not doing it. But I want to clarify. I don't understand when you use a word. I can't just float and not ask you to identify. I can't.
Okay, in this particular case, then.
You have to define the term. You can't say a word like true just like that without sort of going into it.
Okay, well, in this particular case, what you're going to have to do then is let me finish the line of thought that I'm developing.
When you give us a signal or something.
Well, I mean, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to clarify the meaning of the term emptiness. And if you're going to nail me on every word I use along the way, we're going to go in a big circle and get nowhere.
I'm just trying to understand.
I get it. But what I'm saying is that if we're going to have to stop and redefine every single term along the way, I'm not going to be able to define anything.
Let's just define one term tonight, then.
All right, let's go back to working on emptiness.
Mm-hmm. Or you could give us the spiel. And then I could go home and go to bed, and then
and
everybody who didn't get it could stay here and talk with you about what the different terms mean.
Good, that's good. That's a good idea.
Well, that's actually what we were doing in the earlier part of this.
Uh-huh.
You know,
if I was
maybe we should go
selfish about it, so I could get exactly what I wanted, not have to be patient at all.
Maybe we should go back to that. Maybe we should go back to that format.
Sure.
All
let's right. do it. What are you going
to
do?
All right, let's go back to that. All right, so let me finish my spiel, and then Heather can go to bed, which I sympathize with completely. And then you can have some like dialogue with me, and I sympathize with that too, and I'm interested in that.
Yeah.
It's just, it's hard for me to do both.
Yeah.
Okay, back to, so anyhow, so there's three approaches to understanding emptiness, or three arguments for emptiness, and what they have to do with, then, is ways of eradicating the false, or removing the false from the true, or separating the false from the true in phenomena or in experience. Really, basically, all they have to do with. You know, I'll summarize what the three of them are, and then I'll go through them one at a time. Three arguments, or the three approaches, are that phenomena, you know what I mean by phenomena, just anything that you experience, any identifiable aspect of experience. Okay. Phenomena are empty because they depend on causes and conditions. That's one argument. Phenomena are empty because they're compounds, which means they're made out of smaller parts. Phenomena are empty because the qualities that they appear to have are in fact only attributed to them by us. We project those qualities onto them. They're not necessarily there in the phenomena itself. Okay. So those are the three arguments for emptiness. Now, in fact, the first two are just two sides of the same issue. And they refer to the analysis of, as it were, things in themselves, the nature of things in themselves. The third argument about projection really is more focusing back on the observer. Okay, so you can actually divide the two arguments into three arguments into two. An analysis of phenomena on their side and an analysis of phenomena from our side. So let's start on the objective side. And I said that these two arguments were like flip sides of each other, where they dovetail with each other. Okay. And as I said, the place to approach things is to approach things with how they appear, try and understand how they appear, understand what's wrong about our idea about how they appear, and then remove it. Okay. That was the approach. So let's start with this instead of the usual table routine, sort of this plastic box. Okay. Although this is not a particularly, from our point of view at this time, a particularly subtle argument, we know that the box itself is made out of parts. Right? Like this box, which is made out of plastic, if we think about it intellectually, we know really what it's made out of is, you know, molecules that are bonded together in a certain way. And we also know that the molecules, in fact, are made out of subatomic particles, and they bond energy and all this kind of stuff. And we know, because of our scientific educations, although this was not apparent, obviously, to people of 2,500 years ago, right, who could only see what was in front of their eyes, right, we know that that if we look at this box at a certain level of magnitude, it appears to be a whole thing. Right? If we look at it from like the point of view of an electron microscope, right, it no longer appears to be a box. It appears to be what we call molecules or atoms. And if we analyze even farther, although we can't really look at it with any mechanism, that we can intellectually analyze farther and see this, all those molecules as not even actually patterns of energy, but probabilities of energy waves. Okay, so that's three different levels of analysis. At each of those levels of analysis, a reality appears to be completely different. Right? At the level of the molecule, there seems to be like a lattice. At the level of the energy wave, you can't even talk about a structure. You can only talk about the abstractions of probabilities and energies which are defined in certain ways. And if you talk about it at the level of coarse appearance, it appears to be what we call a thing, which is whole in itself. Now those three analyses are not contradictory, even though the fact of what's represented by them is utterly dissimilar. Right? I mean, when we talk about this as a plastic box, in other words, a thing, or we talk about it as a bunch of molecules, or we talk about it as probabilities of energy patterns, we're talking about the same. See, at this point, all you can do is point at it. We're talking about the same, you know, that. Because you can't really call it a thing, because that is negating two of the levels of analysis already. But these are not contradictory, even though they have totally different appearance from each other. Right? So, what's the point of this? Okay, the point of this is the argument about the emptiness of things as being compounds is that the only way that we can experience this box as a thing is by ignoring the deeper levels of analysis. If we experience this as a network or a lattice of molecules, we no longer experience it as a thing. Except what our minds will do is they'll go down to the level of the molecules and experience the molecules as things, but the box not as a thing. Okay. So then we can deconstruct that one almost in a Buddhist fashion, go down to the level of probability waves. We'll say no molecules, only probability waves. But if you watch your mind closely at that level of deconstruction, you'll find that your mind does two things. One, it attributes thingness to waves. And the other thing is it attributes thingness to probability in some way. Now, if you think about what's going on in that process, you'll draw a certain obvious conclusion, which is that thingness, the idea of a thing, is not in the object. The thingness is in the mind, because as soon as you deconstruct it at one level, it appears at another level. And whichever level you look at, the thing returns to that level, even though the notion of thing is contradicted by the level you were just analyzing at. Right? If you analyze at the level of molecule, that would seem to contradict thing at the level of box. But as soon as you go back to looking at box, you see thing. Okay. Now, the abstraction of that idea in and of itself is maybe interesting. But on the other hand, that abstraction, if you bring it into, say, the meditative process, becomes more than just sort of like intellectually interesting. It can have a very interesting impact on, say, Zazen or any other kind of meditation that you're doing. As you notice the way mind insists upon finding things all the time, it becomes a very interesting practice to notice from the point of view of the construction of stuff, how mind insists on finding things in the funniest ways.
In addition to a thing being a physical object, you also mean an idea or a concept?
Well, that gets to one of the other arguments about emptiness, which is the one on the subjective side. So let's hold that for the time being. So anyhow, thingness appears in the experience. Now then there's the argument about cause and effect. Now, when we talk about this, I guess the place that I didn't get us to was, if we look at the process, the analytic process I just described, it was a process of emptying the phenomenon of thingness by using our minds. We used our minds to analyze what was actually there before us, and in the process of doing that, we find that thingness melts away. All right? So when I analyze the box down to the level of molecules, the thingness of box, the box and the thing melts away in what replaces it as a lattice of molecules. Right. But then the concept thingness appears really quickly in regards to each of the individual molecules and some abstract concept of lattice. Right. And then I can analyze that one away and talk about probabilities of energy waves. Right. And what will happen is thingness will reappear in the idea of wave. That you get an image in your mind of wave as a thing when in fact wave isn't a thing. If you look at what the definition of waves are, they're not things. It doesn't really apply to them. But our minds will immediately project thing onto it. So maybe that's an opening for the third argument about emptiness, which is that the qualities that appear in objects aren't really coming from the side of the objects. They're coming from the side of the subject. So it's thingness in this compound isn't to be found in the compound. Thingness is to be found in the mind and is projected onto the compound. It's actually called reification. But there's a concept that we have of an independent entity, and every time we are, or every time, in our flow of experience of the world, we're constantly identifying things in that flow. Things are coming from us. They're not on the side of it. Okay. So that's actually the third argument for emptiness. And for us, it's an easy one because we're pretty psychologically sophisticated. We know what projection is. We've all been to college, so it's not a big issue. But again, if you think about it from the point of view of like 2,500 years ago, this is like not exactly your common knowledge. All right. The third argument has to do with the problem of flow, actually, which is that in identifying things in this process, in creating things in the process, the way in which we identify thingness is, on the one hand, to ignore the fact that it's a compound in the sense of its constituent elements, but we ignore something else about the nature of compounds, which is compounds are, in fact, as compounds, made up of things which have come together at a certain point in time, or are coming together over time. And the implication of that is that they will come apart over time also. Because anything that comes together will come apart. Right. So this is the argument for emptiness of things on the basis of causes and conditions, which is that all compounds are coming together of other elements, which of course in themselves are compounds, but just operating on this coarse level of analysis. All compounds are the coming together of things. In other words, you know, at one time this was beads of plastic before it became a plastic box. And before it was beads of plastic, it was petroleum. Before it was petroleum, it was dinosaurs or coal or whatever it was, right? Okay. So the truth of this plastic box, the truth of the existence of this plastic box, is not something that can, in fact, be separated from dinosaurs. I mean, it's true, right? If the dinosaurs hadn't existed, you know, this TDK D90 plastic box couldn't exist now. There's no way. With no dinosaurs, no plastic boxes. That's simple. So, if that's the case, then this box, for its existence, depends upon those dinosaurs. And what that means is that the actual nature of this box is that it's part of an ongoing flow. That we experience it in a moment, cut off from a flow, and therefore can identify it as abyss, a plastic box. But its true nature is that it's actually part of a flow, which includes dinosaurs, and heaven only knows where it's going. Okay. So then, from the analytic point of view of understanding emptiness, there's three things that actually engage all the time to create appearances. Three features which need to be observed, which are never observed if one's to truly understand any phenomenon. One thing is that the phenomenon itself is a compound, it's made of bits. The other thing is that the bits are held together at any point in time as part of a flowing process. And the third thing is that the mere fact that in any given moment we're identifying that phenomenon as bits held together in a flowing process is a matter of the mind projecting a concept onto a chunk of experience to isolate that chunk of experience out of its flow and ignoring its compounded elements. Okay. So emptiness is about removing those three falsehoods in every moment in regards to every experience. That's actually all emptiness is about. It's not about anything else. There's nothing left over in the concept of emptiness than that. Now, you, David, you brought up earlier, he says about form and emptiness, right? Well, emptiness is just, you know, I don't remember exactly what you said, an aspect of form or the other side of form or something like that. Okay, in Buddhist parlance, this is what's called form. It's something that I can perceive through my eyes.
That was form and emptiness.
This, in Buddhist parlance, this is called form. Something I can perceive through my eyes. Okay.
This is the part we're talking about.
Not yet.
Okay.
In its nature, though, it's empty. And what does it mean to say that it's empty? All right. Like when the sutra said form is emptiness, emptiness is not different from form. What does it mean? Okay. It means that in its nature, which is its appearance as independent, partless, and being a box, which is exactly how it appears to us, in its nature of being that way or appearing that way, it is actually devoid of those very three things. It's actually devoid and never has had any character which is more than the sum of its parts. It's never had any character which is other than being a moment in a flow, and which is completely dependent on all the previous moments, and it's never had anything of its own nature that wasn't projected onto it by me or you. And that's always been there in it. And that's what the sutra means when it says there's no difference between form and emptiness. Because you can't empty this form. You can't empty this form, right, unless the form is there to be emptied. And what's not in it is always there with it, if that makes any sense at all. Does that make any sense at all? Maybe it doesn't make any sense.
I lost it, but I was trying.
Yeah.
Well, I got it right into the last, just the last part. Just
okay.
That very last part. What's not in it is always.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you mean the, like the dinosaurs and the globules, the plastic, and what do you mean?
Yeah, okay. The appearance of this is that it's independent of the dinosaurs.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. But the fact
but
that
if you look back at where it came from, it is integrally connected.
Okay. Has this box ever been anything other than transformed dinosaur?
It has that in it, but it's different than what it used to be.
Okay. But has it ever been other than, has it ever existed
no,
independent? Has it ever existed independently of the dinosaurs in
no.
a causal sense? Right.
No.
Okay. So its lack of independence of the dinosaurs has always been there with it.
Yeah, it's like I'm not my grandpa, and if he was sitting next to me on the seat, we look different.
Right.
But I, who I am, couldn't have happened without.
Well, his being there. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then
so
there's some other people involved in that too.
That's true.
Like besides the dinosaurs.
That's true too. Okay, and I'm just following a single line.
Yeah.
It's simpler. Okay, so there is no time in the existence of Heather
mm-hmm.
when Heather has been other than dependent on her grandfather to exist. Or she's do you want to flip it? Should I shut up or what? Yeah, that's a good time. I'm a baseball fan. Or baseball fan. Good. Okay, there's been no time, at no time has the nature of Heather
mm-hmm.
ever lacked her existential dependence on her grandfather. Okay. At no time have we ever actually seen Heather's grandfather in Heather.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when one says that there's no difference between form and emptiness, it means that the form, Heather, has never at any time been anything other than lacking our fictional notions of her independence of her grandfather. Was that any clearer?
So the only thing that we can say about it for certain is the only thing we can say about a form is that it's lacking. That it's lacking this.
Yeah, actually that's true. The only thing that you can say for certain about anything, absolutely and positively, is that it's empty or devoid of everything that you believe about it. That it's empty or devoid of all your notions of it, and that it is empty or devoid of everything about how it appears to you.
What if you say emptiness, you said interconnectedness?
If you say interconnectedness, you're speaking about the way in which the phenomenon actually relates to other phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with that statement is that in order to have phenomena that are interconnected, you have to assert phenomena, things.
Yes.
See, our minds won't accept interconnectedness without things to be connected.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so
okay.
It asserts the fact of thingness. And there's nothing wrong with that, as long as you also recognize that those interconnected things are empty of the thingness you believe they have. Because things are defined as not dependent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see, in our minds we can think of interconnectedness because we can think of things connected to each other, like in a web.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really look closely at what's going on in your mind when you're holding those thoughts, you'll notice that there's a contradiction going on. And a contradiction is you'll see in your mind things which are connected.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get the connectedness side of things. But if you look at the way your mind has defined the things that are connected,
mm-hmm.
you'll see on a subtle level, it's defined them by disconnecting them.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you can say, I'm made up of my grandpa, but then who is he made up of, and who is he made up of? And if you go back far enough, it falls apart, and where are the dinosaurs before?
Mm-hmm.
They, you know.
Right.
If you go behind the dinosaurs, behind that.
Nothing is findable, right?
You can't ever stop.
Right, and what does that mean? It means that nothing is findable in
mm-hmm.
that respect. Okay, you remember earlier what I said was that you can separate what's true and what's false, because when you analyze that which is true, remains when you push the analysis farther, and that which just falls and disappears when you push the analysis farther. Okay, so you just push the analysis to the ultimate limit, and everything disappeared,
mm-hmm.
right? Which means that at the level of thing, there's nothing there. Because you can't
mm-hmm.
find it when you really honestly pursue the analysis.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the ways that the Tibetans define that which is empty or that which is false better. The way the Tibetans define that which is false is that which is not findable upon ultimate analysis. If you do the analysis correctly and you push it to its ultimate limit, then the thing you're ascertaining disappears. If the thing you're trying to ascertain disappears, that means it's false. If you push the analysis to its ultimate limit, and the thing you're trying to ascertain remains, then it's true. Okay. So now if you think about this, we've talked about analyzing all kinds of phenomena. What is the one phenomenon that you can analyze and you push the analysis to its ultimate limit and it remains? That's it. It's the only thing that's left over. That's exactly right. Huh?
Space.
Well, no, he said space is a permanent phenomenon, but even space is empty. Let's maybe not get this. You're right. I understand why you brought that one up. But we're not talking about the difference between permanence and impermanence. We're talking about things which can withstand an ultimate analysis and remain on their own and can't be deconstructed or obliterated by the analysis.
So interconnectedness as well?
Well, see, in the end, actually even interconnectedness gets wiped out.
Oh, because of what you just said, okay.
Right, because you've got to have things to connect.
Suchness.
Suchness.
That's the only thing.
Suchness is just another way of talking about emptiness.
Yeah, emptiness is the only thing.
Well, that's all that remains.
That's all. Yeah.
Right. In this case, I want to avoid using the word "that's the only thing," because we just got through kind of things. Yeah. You know, English language becomes a problem too. But yeah, suchness remains. It's the reason this kind of weird language
arises.
No, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say emptiness, because non-existence, that's a whole different domain, which we can get into if you want. But emptiness and non-existence don't mean the same thing. Okay. And the reason for that is, although emptiness is all that remains upon ultimate analysis of anything, just as the sutra says, form isn't different from emptiness, you know. Although emptiness is the only thing that remains upon ultimate analysis, there's the base of what you proceeded to get to the emptiness with in your analysis, which was form.
Say that again.
The way you got to your, the way in you proceed in your analysis to get to where empty, everything is empty,
yes.
Right, is you got to have things to be empty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about emptiness? Emptiness isn't a thing.
Emptiness isn't a thing, but you do have the concept of emptiness.
No, emptiness doesn't have the concept.
No, you have the concept of emptiness. And that's something that you actually have to deconstruct. You have to empty emptiness of your ideas of what it means.
I'm not understanding this.
I'm not surprised. That's a hard one. Right? See, what we've done is we've created the concept in this hour. We've created the concept of emptiness. What does emptiness mean? Right? We just got it. Upon ultimate analysis, the only thing that's left is emptiness. That's a concept.
But wait, slow.
Okay. Upon ultimate analysis, the only thing that can be said to truly exist is emptiness.
But does it?
And that's a concept.
Can I ask a question? Is this the time?
Yeah, but do you get it?
No, I don't.
Okay, I'm answering the question. Upon ultimate analysis, all that remains is emptiness. That is an idea.
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
But say, forget the analysis part. Forget the all that stuff. How about the experience?
Oh, okay.
Or the intuition.
Well, let's not use the word intuition, because who knows what that might mean.
The experience?
Yeah. The experience of emptiness.
Non-conceptual direct experience.
The non-conceptual direct experience of emptiness. Okay. That is not a concept, and that is not something that has to be further analyzed. Okay. But the way you get there is first you develop the concept of emptiness, so you know what it is that's emptiness, so you can look for it, and then you can have the experience of it.
Because I understand that from the stories. You know, the guy said, well, I heard a rock hit another rock, and I realized emptiness. Or I heard the fluid in the meadow, and I realized emptiness. You know what I mean?
Something okay, like but that. You see, in that kind of situation, like this is like Zen stories, what you have is you have people who've been sitting around during Zazen for a long time trying to ascertain what this experience is, and at a certain point they crossed over and they had it. Okay.
But also there's people who have analysis.
Probably not.
Rare.
Probably never.
Never.
Why should it?
Because
why should they fall out of the web of delusion by accident?
Because it is a web of delusion. Because they just realize the obvious. Because they.
But is it obvious?
Emptiness.
What's obvious about it?
I think I do agree with.
Do you?
Dave here, because something Blanche said that before she ever heard of Zen, she was involved in. She was intervening between riot police and students who were protesting, and she like ducked under some students to interpose herself as, you know, an older person to kind of like try and keep them apart. And she just had made eye contact with a riot policeman, and she just understood that everything that he stood for was like the opposite of how she felt herself. But she made this eye contact, and she could identify with him.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that was, it really affected her, that she was very attracted to Suzuki Roshi because she felt like he understood that experience.
But that strikes me as an experience of a deep identity that two beings have with each other. It doesn't strike me as an intuitive understanding of emptiness.
I think she saw
that
the whole way he was because everything that happened to him in his life, and that happened to the people who influenced his life, and happened to them, and so there's the same idea of what was before the dinosaur.
But then I would say that was a deep experience of interconnectedness.
Yeah, and then you didn't. You still were stuck on the interconnectedness, the things that.
But I don't. I'm not gonna. It's not appropriate for me to sit here after the fact, mediated by your story, to interpret Blanche's Satori experience or whatever it was. But from what I'm hearing, it sounds like a profound experience of interconnectedness, but it doesn't necessarily sound like it was a deep understanding of emptiness in the way in which I'm talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that's obvious about emptiness.
Oh, okay.
And
I know what I was trying to say.
Okay. What's that?
The obvious part about it is that instead, what you've been talking about basically is investigating the nature of things,
mm-hmm.
and deconstructing them. Am I right? Is that what
yes.
you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one side of it, but the other side of it is to examine the subject,
mm-hmm.
and deconstruct the subject. And since the subject is much closer to us than things, that it seems to me you don't need a lot of analyzing. All you need to do is look. All you need to do is look for the subject and say, like the koan, you know, it's a koan, it's like mu or whatever. You look for the subject, and when you find the subject is not there, it's like, what? There's no subject. And as soon as there's no subject, there's no object. So you have an instant thing. It's like, instant, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, no subject, no object, emptiness.
The problem with that, David, and here I'll refer to something that Rabbit said, the problem with that is that you're talking about looking at the subject, and what do you think, what happens?
This is what I've heard, okay? When you look for the subject,
yeah.
the moment that the subject reveals itself as being absent.
Which is a moment when you can't find it?
Well, it was never there at the beginning. Okay, it's a moment of going from egocentricity. This is a quote. It's a moment of going from egocentricity to zero-centricity.
That's just more language to me. I don't know what that means.
It's a coined word, I'm sure. But the point is, you don't deconstruct the thing. You just look for the subject.
Well,
and the subject basically does not exist. Ramana Maharshi. Okay, where
that's not what Ramana Maharshi said.
Pardon?
That is not what Ramana Maharshi said.
No, he just said, you know, is it...
He didn't say the subject doesn't exist.
Okay, let's not talk about him then. I'm sorry about him. But I'm just, you know, going from the idea of not deconstructing the thing, but actually searching for the subject.
Okay.
Finding its actions.
Yeah, well, all right. Then that's fine.
That's analytical.
Yeah, but that is analytical.
It's not usually like that.
No, it's not analytical. It's merely observation. It's not...
Okay. Well, you see...
I mean, it worked with me.
Analytical and observation are not necessarily contradictory. Okay. I mean, analytical starts out as being like abstractive and conceptual, right? But when you get into analytical in that respect really deeply, it becomes experiential, right? It when you really get into it, it shifts out of the abstraction of concept into what are we trying to get at here? It won't stay at the level of concept. It insists on getting down to the level of experience, especially if you're dealing analytically with subjective stuff. Okay. And the thing is, though, that yes, you're right, the subjective stuff is closer than the objective stuff. But it's slipperier and harder to deal with.
It's different, yeah. It's I have a feeling, what I'm hearing here is like, this is the argument like of gradual and sudden almost. It's like, is this part of it? Maybe part of it, but...
Maybe that's interesting.
But I think it's like two schools of thought. There's like one school of thought that says, you know, take apart the subject, or take apart the object,
yeah.
And you'll see that there's no object. Another school says, look for the subject, and you'll find there's no subject.
Well,
so basically just looking at the same thing, but from two sides.
Okay. This kind of analysis that I'm proposing is applicable to both subject and object. In fact, it's much more powerful if you apply it to subject than if you apply it to object. But it's more difficult to apply to subject than object. I mean, Dalai Lama made a statement that was really stuck in my mind. He said he was referring to what you're talking about as subject, and his school of thought is called mental consciousness, okay, which is the consciousness which is aware of ideas. Okay, it's the consciousness of ideas, or the consciousness of perceptions. Or the consciousness of memories, or the consciousness of thoughts. You can label this any way you want, but it's like mind aware of mind in a certain respect. Okay? He said, if you can analyze that consciousness or that mind and ascertain its emptiness, that's the most potent thing you can do. I mean, literally, what the English translation of his words is, because I don't think he phrased it that way in English, although he might have, is if you can do this, if you can analyze in this way, then there is, quote, progress like unto nothing else, unquote. So that's sort of an absolutist statement. When he says progress like unto nothing else, he means there is nothing that is as profoundly powerful a spiritual process as doing this. It's an unequivocal statement. Nothing. Nothing else. But the difficulty is doing this analysis of the subject that you're proposing, because it's very slippery. Now, I'll show you how slippery it is. Everything that you look for as being the subject within you, if you ascertain it to try and analyze it, it's not the subject, because you're ascertaining it, so it's an object. If this is the hand trying to grasp itself, okay. So how are you going to perform this analysis on the actual subject when you can't find it?
Totally, absolutely right. I mean, you can't find it. And that's why I'm not suggesting to analyze it. I'm simply saying, or what I simply just said is to look for it.
But if you can't find it, what does that mean to look for it? What does it mean then when you can't find it?
Well, it's because I think part of us accepts its existence. Part of us believes in it. Mm-hmm. Part of us has become so accustomed to it and so been conditioned and indoctrinated to believe it does exist, that, you know, there's a part of us that says, of course I can do this, I can do that, and so forth. But what Buddha is saying and all the teachers are saying is that drop it. Drop all that stuff.
What stuff is it that they're saying to drop?
Greed, hate, delusion.
Okay, but they're not saying that just because you can't find the subject that it doesn't exist.
Well, the subject and the object both expect each other to support each other, right? The subject and the object.
You can't have one without the other, right? Yeah.
Mutually dependent.
Yeah.
And if you're proposing the object can be destructed from emptiness, it logically follows that the subject can also be shot to the empty.
That's correct.
And since the, whatever you want to call us, I don't know what you're saying, we are people or persons or whatever, composites. Capabilities of mental discrimination, but we also have abilities of, you know, I call it intuition, you might not like that, but it could be termed like a combination of physical and emotional abilities to look, like an emotional apperception, emotional intuition, as well as a physical intuition. So you have your zazen posture, which sets up a physical state of immobility, of silence, of quietude, basically not just doesn't require any energy to keep it. It just basically you sit and it just stays there. You don't have to worry about it. And if you can quiet your mind, then your emotions can sort of like, you know, go like this and intuit. It's not just an intellectual thing, is what I'm saying. It's not an analysis. It's a total looking of your whole being for its center. For something that's there.
For the center of the being.
The center of the being. And they say, when you do that, you will find it. You will find it.
Who says you'll find it?
What?
Who says you'll find it?
Who says you find it? 99% of everybody.
Really?
Sure, my parents.
Buddha doesn't say that.
Well, Buddha, of course. He knows. He knows the truth.
But he doesn't say that you're going to find the subject when you look for it.
But I'm saying, when I was a kid, everyone told me that I had a subject.
But you see, the question is, if you can't find it, what does that mean?
It doesn't mean anything.
Well, what do you mean? How can you say that if everybody around believes that there's truly a subject home, there's somebody in here, a subject,
right?
And if when you look for the subject you can't find it,
right?
How can you say that doesn't mean anything?
Well, it doesn't mean anything to them. It means something to me.
What does it mean to you?
It means that everything's totally different than what I was taught.
That's one thing. Okay. Well, what else does it mean? Because that's a pretty coarse conclusion.
It's what?
I mean, that's socially profound, but philosophically it's a coarse conclusion.
I don't know anything about philosophy.
Well, experientially, what does it mean when you firmly believe that you are a subject?
It just makes things much more fun. It makes things much more lighthearted.
I think that's true, but I think you're also avoiding answering my question.
No, I'm not. It seems like you want a certain answer. I don't know what you want.
Well, I'm being provocative here.
Cool, that's great.
I am being provocative. And there are certain, I think, outcomes to sort of facing this point, which are revolutionary.
What are you getting at?
If you can't find the subject, no matter how hard you look for the subject, what does that mean?
I'll let you know when I get there.
What do you think it means?
I don't think you can tell them.
Sounds like what you're saying is that it's just one of the things that lead us to understanding emptiness, which means that it's false. Right? But that kind of freaks me out, because then it seems to me to be leading into that all of this is false, and then we start running into nihilism.
That's a danger.
And
that's a danger.
I don't know.
Okay. All right. So let me address that. And I'll address your question also. If you can't find the subject, okay, at all, when you look for it,
and, well, okay, a separate subject? Or, no, I think there may be, I've heard there's like an ultimate subject.
If you can't find any subject when you look for it.
Consciousness, thought, consciousness, like
yeah.
You saying before,
yeah.
Okay.
Or any, if you, okay, we've defined the subject as that which knows,
mm-hmm.
Let's say.
Which knows?
That which knows.
Knows implies some kind of mental thing.
Always aware.
That
aware, which knows
right.
Or is aware.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. If you can't find it, right, it means that that which you've proposed as existing as a subject, which logically seems to have to exist, okay, but can't be found, it means there's something wrong with your concept of what it is, for one thing. Okay. So, for one thing, right, we have firmly believed that there's a difference between subject and object. But if you can't find a subject, you could come to the conclusion that no subject exists, and therefore that no object exists, which would be the nihilistic conclusion that's worrying you. Okay. Or you could come to the conclusion that there's something wrong with your idea that there is a subject, and something wrong with your idea that there is an object. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, this is one of the great gifts that Reb gave me, the fact of the matter is that all you can experience is experience in which what you abstractly understand to be subject and object are inextricably meshed together. It doesn't mean that either of them is completely non-existent, except whatever your concept about them was. But it means that what you were attempting to refer to with those concepts of subject and object, that what appeared to be two are so inextricably connected to each other that it's only in the abstraction of thought that you can separate them. But at no level of experience can they ever be separated. That subject and object are mere abstractions. That in the fact of experience, experience doesn't have to do with subject and object. But you can't separate them out. If it's unfindable, if the subject is unfindable, no matter how closely you look for it, all that can possibly mean is that it's an abstraction. Now, it could be that the abstraction refers to something, but you can't find it. So, I mean, that.
What about
you can't find it separate from other things?
You can't find the subject, ever find the subject separate from object. Okay. So, I mean, I really want to sit with this, because if where the drift of this conversation is leading you off to this kind of nihilistic place, I don't even want to walk out of the room, you know, leaving it that way, because that's such a problematic situation to leave someone in, right? The conclusion that one can come to, which is the dangerous conclusion, is if you can't find the subject, it doesn't exist. So that's the nihilistic conclusion.
I guess my problem is that the word this is false.
Okay.
So I guess now I've switched how I'm understanding that word.
False. Yeah.
That our ideas about what's happening is false, but it's happening nonetheless.
Right. That's the point. Something is going on, but it's not what we think is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In other words, there is appearance. That's all there is. There's appearance, you know. And we take appearance to be just what it is. That's ignorance. Or we can take appearance to be merely appearance, and then there is what is, which is not appearance. Or, to use a metaphor, which is, I think, sort of cuts through all the abstractions, there's the difference between that which is a dream and that which is dreamlike. So if you think that the world is just a dream, then you're saying that the world is unreal. And that's not what Buddhists are saying. Actually, that's what Hindus are saying. If you say that the world is just a dream, then it's to be discounted. It's irrelevant, unless dreams are important to you. But if you say the world is dreamlike, What that means is that there's a world, but it has a certain quality which is problematic, which is that it appears one way, but that's not quite the way it is. It has sort of like a slippery, uncertain aspect to it. But it doesn't make it not exist or not be. But it changes the notion of the way it is.
That's the thing that you're about saying. False is like good in a logic conversation, or it's either true or false. Kind of more, it's like maybe it works better to say is it not quite right. I was thinking about reading a newspaper, and it, like a reputable newspaper.
It's broken.
Where you'd say, you read a story, you're getting someone else's view of this story. You're not getting the actual event that happened. You can be fairly, if it's a repeatable newspaper, you can be fairly certain that there's something happened, but you're not getting the whole story. You're not getting everything. You're getting a small take, an abstraction, after the fact, through someone else's personality, and their interests is reflected in that story. So it's not quite right. It's not the same thing, but it's, there's something going on.
It's like seeing this is not... It's like seeing this as not dependent on dinosaurs is like the dream aspect of it. It's like seeing it just here by itself. Seeing this as not dependent on its causes, seeing this as not dependent on dinosaurs, that's this dreamlike quality. You know, seeing it is not composed out of parts, that's its dreamlike quality. You know, seeing it as completely independent, that's its dreamlike quality. But there's something there. It's not that there's nothing there. It's just that what's there in truth, I will come back to that, what's there in truth is other than what's there in appearance. And that's why the appearance is false. Because the appearance does not reflect the truth of what the thing is.
Oh, like what Jeremy said, the appearance is only part of the story, and there's a bigger story.
Right.
It's like, you know, you have some actor, you only talk to one witness.
Yeah.
If you just see the tape sitting there.
Right. But it is false. Like you use the example of you only talk to one witness when there's an accident. Okay. One witness gives you a certain perspective. And if you take that perspective to be the truth, it isn't. It's actually false. It's a perspective. Right? Yeah. But it is false.
Okay. Can I? All right. The opinion of the one witness doesn't become false until we take it into ourselves and make and label it back to the whole story.
That's, yeah.
Uh-huh. But if you just say this is the opinion of the witness, it doesn't have to actually all of a sudden be false. It's just what it is.
No, it does have to be false, because we're talking about the true story. It's false.
As soon as you relate it to...
You can say it is what it is, but that's not the same as...
It's false only in relation to the whole...
Try this. It's a true
story.
It's a true opinion, but it's not the truth.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. It's a true opinion, but it's not the truth. And there's a difference between a true opinion and the truth.
It might be... as objectively as possible, everything this one person saw, but it's still not the whole story.
Exactly so. And that's, effectively, that's really what emptiness is about. I mean, to use this example.
Yeah, it just felt like, you know, you're giving the witness a, you know, calling their story false right off.
Well, okay.
I don't know.
But see, the fact of the matter is
the
that we're people who will just accept the truth of the one witness all the time, moment by moment. And that's why it's kind of fair to refer to it as false, because it's our habit to do so.
Yeah.
And so we live in a world of false appearance, because the appearance of the world we live in is that things are in a certain way, but if we really consider that, we find that none of that's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like living every minute as if we're eternal. If we think about it, we know it's not true, but that's not how we live every minute. There's no reason to pursue things any farther than that. But I was really very concerned to not leave things in a problematic place for you. I mean, I'm not sure if we resolve it entirely.
Right.
Yeah, but maybe it's giving you something to work with and to think about. And I think that it's that the, for me, anyhow, the language that's been most helpful is to work with the distinction of dream and dreamlike, because I can feel comfortable with rejecting dream as somehow non-existent, although that's actually not true. But certainly as I can work with rejecting dream from the point of view of objective reality, I can see dream as irrelevant. It doesn't count, you know. But dreamlike has a whole different kind of tone to it, and a whole different kind of dimension to it, which suggests an underlying something that might be of real significance. And that's a key point. And I truly believe that this is the real distinction between the Buddhists and the Hindus is over this particular point of dream versus dream life. Because, I mean, in Hinduism you have, like, you know, you have Vishnu who dreams the world, and at a certain point then he wakes up. And when he wakes up, our world disappears. And I think that where you end up with that kind of notion of the world as a dream is in some very problematic places about being willing to make a commitment to it, you know. So it's the reason why the Bodhisattva path is something that you find in, for the most part, only in Buddhism, and you don't tend to find it in Hinduism. Although you can actually find it in Hinduism, you have to sort of work yourself into it on the basis of some pretty profound realization. Like you look at someone like Ramakrishna, okay. And you find coming out of his teachings about things, you find a version of the Bodhisattva path. But if you look at somebody like Shankara, and all you get is like just like a total renunciation of the world's worthless, you know, because it's just a big illusion, it's a big dream, and it's worth nothing. The only thing that's worth anything is the subject out of which this dream is emerging. And I think that that's pretty problematic, actually. You know, I think it is pretty problematic. I think it really fits into, you know, why you have the kind of India that you have, as a matter of fact. I mean, I like India. I'm not knocking India. I'm just saying that from the point of view of like a cultural or intellectual history of a location, I think one of the reasons that you can have the kind of place that you have, you know, is like that. Actually, I was going to do something with carrots, but do you want to end with a... That's the brakes. No, I think it's fine. Huh? Okay, that's a good place to end. Good.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, yeah, 7:15 next week.
7:15.
Yeah, we'll do 7:15. I think it's a little bit better. Are you just sort of floating through or what?
Oh, all right.
Well,
no.
Well,
I just the
7:15 next week, I think, is a little bit better. Is that better for you? Worse for you?
It doesn't matter. Today, I just got a phone call.
Yeah. Anyhow, it's better for Sonia. And maybe it's even better for me, too, because I noticed that as 7 o'clock was rolling around, I was sitting in the dining room talking, and sometimes what happens is that happens.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It is.